Welcome to this evening's lecture. It's hosted by Legatum Institute. I'm its executive director, Sian Hansen, and you are very, very welcome. And I'd also like to include all of you who've joined us online. I understand that we have audiences from all over the world, not only Athens, but Rome, New York, Boston, Abu Dhabi, and Vancouver. And I'd like to also thank our sponsors, Cerno Capital and Ophiel Partners. Thank you very much. And if you'd like to tweet this evening, the hashtag is ClassicBoris. So please do join in. The Legatum Institute is an independent educational charity. It promotes, fosters, and encourages prosperity all around the world. If you'd like to know more about our work or about our future events, please do go to our website, get involved. In fact, I'd love it. We'd all love it if you got involved, so please do. And it's just wonderful to see such a diverse audience tonight. We have historians, sculptors, we have academics and policymakers, and well, let's face it, fans of Boris. Fans of Boris. And now, I'd like to introduce you to our senior advisor at Legatum Institute, Hal Williams.
It's a fair bet, ladies and gentlemen, that there was only one British politician this summer who spent at least part of his vacation reacquainting himself with the history of the Peloponnesian War and that classic account of the three decades almost of struggle between democratic Athens and oligarchy Sparta, written by the great Greek historian Thucydides. It will equally, I think, come as no surprise to you to learn that that particular British public figure who did achieve that feat and to great personal enjoyment is with us this evening. A time there was when invocations and references to the glory that was Greece, the grandeur that was Rome, was a staple feature of British political life, when statesmen sought to impress on their audiences the analogies between past and present, between classical culture and the present, thereby seeking to cajole, entertain, and infuse. After all, we are in the London townhouse of William Ewart Gladstone, four times Prime Minister, who as Chancellor of the Exchequer, came very close to abolishing income tax completely. A very important figure, therefore, and very dear to the heart of the Legatum Institute. But despite these remarkable achievements, it's a fair bet that what Gladstone himself took most pleasure in during his life were the three volumes of his work that were dedicated to Homeric scholarship, stuff that he would have done in this very building. Well, times passed and standards of taste change. Not many scholars, and indeed not many scholar politicians, have the kind of authority anymore that Boris brings to the subject. And though times may change, the immense appetite that he brings to the cultivation of scholarship and to really its importance for contemporary Britain stands as really something that is quite exceptional, I think, in the public life of our time. When I think of Boris, as I often do, I'm sometimes reminded, if you allow me the analogy, of the Colossus of Rhodes. His sturdy frame, standing astride on the earth, solidly fixed with an eye to political reality, but also somehow rising above the day-to-day events and with a kind of imaginative grasp of the public issues of our time that makes him such an exceptional figure, somebody who almost transcends the rage of party. So when it came to the whole question of how to find somebody who would deal with this question, the relationship between London, early 21st century AD, huge metropolis, and 5th century BC, Athens, there was really not much of a contest in our minds. Indeed, there is something peculiarly felicitous about what's happening here this evening. This conjunction, as it were, of three stars: Periclean Athens, the London of Boris, and the Legatum Institute Foundation. Since with a zest and a scholarship that may be typical indeed of Boris himself, our studies, as Sian has just reminded us, devoted to the culture of prosperity and to understanding in a unique way a mission that is both international and also synoptic in its focus. Something very Athenian about that, the first civilization that hit the high spots all the way around, and something very Legatum and something very Borisian. Ladies and gentlemen, Boris Johnson.
Thank you very, very much, Hal. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening indeed to Moscow, Paris, New York, wherever, Abu Dhabi, everywhere else that we're talking, Massachusetts, everywhere else that we're talking to tonight. A great pleasure to be here at the Legatum Institute. I had a misspent youth, my friends, during the period when most normal adolescents are learning key life skills, playing Grand Theft Auto, or discovering 10 interesting facts about Pamela Anderson. I'm afraid I would take the tube by myself at the age of about 13 and visit the British Museum. And I would walk through the cat-headed Egyptians and the cloven-hoofed Babylonians and the typewriter-bearded Assyrians and all the other savage and ludicrous Near Eastern divinities until I penetrated the sanctum sanctorum, the innermost and holiest shrine of London's greatest cultural temple, the Duveen Galleries. And there, like so many before and since, I would give thanks again to that slightly dim-witted 7th Earl of Elgin. And yes, I would mentally congratulate that reviled but blameless Scottish diplomat who in 1803 spent the stonking sum of £75,000 of his own money to rescue those treasures from the Ottoman lime kiln, and thereby allowed me and every other Londoner to form a glimmer of an understanding of that revolution which took place in 5th century Athens. You go into that room and you feel you are in a new and better world. Welcome, come and have a seat. A new and better world. You've left behind the totalitarian tyrannies with their rigid and robotic processions of prisoners, their undifferentiated armies, their scenes of humiliation and massacre, the headless corpses chucked, plus ça change, alas, into the Tigris. You notice a change in mood. It's not just the quality of the sculpture, that has taken a hyperleap forward with a new accuracy and fluency in the modelling. It's in the attitude towards the subject. You look at the riders of the Panathenaic frieze, and you see this guy's got his boots on, this one's chosen sandals for the big day, one's tapping his head, this one's having difficulties with an obstreperous cow, and you realise in the swivel of the hips and the unique articulation of the neck that the sculptors were trying to say something new. These people were idealized, certainly, but they were meant to be the real people of Athens, the ordinary people. And in their scale and in the attention to detail, they were just as important as anyone else on that frieze. No smaller, just as big, and just as carefully rendered as the Olympian gods themselves. And so after thousands of years of civilization, and after centuries of abject quivering before fish gods and cow gods and sky gods, you are seeing the arrival of the individual, center stage at last in the story of humanity. I was vaguely capable of understanding this as a teenager, and the Greeks themselves, and especially the Athenians, thought something very wonderful was going on. The world is full of amazing things, says Sophocles, who had fought with Pericles in the same military campaign, and nothing is more amazing than man. Not Zeus with his thunderbolts, not Poseidon with his earthquakes, not even Apollo with his plagues. Man is the strangest and scariest thing on the planet. Man is the measure of all things, said Protagoras of Abdera, who was also the teacher of Pericles. And the Greeks were really the first to try to take the measure of all things. And so when you look at that supernova of classical Athenian intellectual activity, the blasphemous inquiries of the philosophers, the scatological satire of the comedians, the pervy psychological probing of the tragedians, the cynicism of the historians, Aristotle's musings on the sex life of the cuttlefish, you ask yourself, why then? Why did it all come together in 5th century Athens? And it helped, obviously, that they were relatively prosperous. They'd found a huge silver mine at Larium in Attica, and in 483 BC, they took the crucial strategic decision that great leaders should do, to invest in transport infrastructure. And with the biggest fleet in the Aegean and the entire Mediterranean, they were able to control maritime traffic and to impose a tax on virtually every boat afloat. But it wasn't just a question of economics. Look again at those friezes and those metopes and pediment in the British Museum. What do you notice, or rather, what absence do you notice? Who is not there amongst the ordinary Athenians? Harry. Like the near, again, in the Near Eastern friezes, there are animals with human heads, I admit. There are some animals with human heads. The centaurs, though they are being defeated, note, defeated, not worshipped. There are scenes of battle, though there is no horror, no torture. There are some headless people, in fact, there are quite a lot of headless people, including one, but many, because they had their heads knocked off by accident. There's one poor Lapith whose head is in Athens and whose body is in London. And I think his head should be restored to London from Athens, in my view. Anyway, there are no intentionally decapitated people, but somebody is missing. Some category of being is missing. Who is missing? No, there are plenty of women, actually. There are no. I don't know if there are attached letters or not. I haven't got iconographical expertise. There is. Come on. No, not slaves. Come on, you weren't paying attention. Who said that? There is no king. There is no king, there is no pharaoh, there is no Basileus, there is no ruler having his boots licked by the fawning chamberlain. Right? The Parthenon is an absolutely explicit piece of ideology. It's a celebration of people power. This Parthenon is not only a treasure house and a nationalist expression of Athenian money and might with a ton of gold swaddled around Athena. It is a gigantic painted jewel box that exalts the triumph over the Athenians over the barbarians, a reminder that twice in living memory they have prevailed over the swarming hordes of the Persian king. And the reason they won was not that they were like they feared the king or his or death at the hands of his slave masters. That was what the Persians feared. They won because they were fighting for an idea, weren't they? For freedom, for rights that were conferred 60 years ago when Cleisthenes, 507, the great uncle of Pericles, instituted a system of government that had never been tried before on earth, and by which we still claim to be governed today, and which we call democracy. And of course, Athenian democracy was very far from perfect, and when we say Pericles was a democrat, we should immediately qualify that, as Thucydides does, by pointing out that he exercised supreme power for a very long time, and he didn't just devote himself to Keynesian programs of public works. he was a general, a warrior, and the reason he wore a helmet the whole time was not because he rode a bike, but because he wore, not just because he was bald, though he was, or that he had a strange dolichocephalic skull. Means head us a little bit like alien in profile. But the reason he did was because he led his troops in war. He really did. And when Pericles and his hoplites went to suppress a rebellion, as happened with the people of Samos, they behaved with oriental savagery, allegedly crucifying the ringleaders in the marketplace or branding their skins with symbols of subjection. It was Pericles. We don't have his statue here, unfortunately, but there's plenty of images of him around the place. Pericles, who converted the Delian League to the Athenian Empire, who took the treasure house, the treasure, all the money, from Delos to Athens, and in the run-up to the ultimately disastrous Peloponnesian War, he behaved like a super hawk. He refused to compromise. He dismissed any suggestion that there should be some kind of UN-style peace initiative. He told the Athenians that they could win, and he promised that if they did what he said, they would win. And he got them to subordinate their interests to the interests of the state. So they evacuated their farms and allowed them to be ravaged by the Spartans, and the population of Attica, of Athens, probably about 400,000 people, by far the biggest city in Greece, the metropolis of the ancient world, was penned up behind those long walls, with the result that huge numbers of them succumbed to terrible plague that killed two of Pericles' sons and indeed the man himself. So Pericles in Athens was avowedly the heart of an empire that exacted, a militaristic empire that exacted tribute and ruled by force. And it was worse than that, as we all know. It was a slave state, as some of you were bursting to point out just now, with perhaps as many as 50,000 slaves, people who lived in various degrees of subordination, men and women who could be beaten by their owners with impunity or used as sexual partners with little or no concept of consent. As for the lives of the so-called free women, we all know that in Athens they had virtually no formal political power or rights. And just because the system was called a democracy, that did not stop the Athenians from taking dreadful decisions like sending the ships to massacre the entire population of Melos in, I think, 416, which is, by any standards, a war crime. And yet, for all its faults, it was a democracy. The first time in history they took power, kratos, that is hard power, not just arche, which kind of means leadership, I think. I know. And it gave the right to exercise that kratos to the demos. And for the first time, therefore, thousands and thousands of ordinary people, many as 10,000 perhaps, would crowd onto that hill, the Pnyx, and they were the first society, they'd have votes, they were the first society to have a parliament. 500 people prepared the business and drafted the laws for the assembly. The first time ever the people were paid by the state to perform public service, 3 obols a day to sit on the jury, jolly good money. The first society to ensure mass enjoyment of the arts by giving people 2 obols to subsidize attendance at the theater, 2 obols, so you could go to the theater, fantastic. But, well, like the Freedom Pass, I suppose. The first society when you could not only elect people, and don't forget Pericles was elected strategos year after year for 15 years, but where you could get a bit of broken pot, scratch a name on it, and you could send any politician you didn't like, no matter how powerful, into exile. That is people power, isn't it? Ostracism could happen to anybody. It happened to Themistocles, even though he defeated the Persians at Salamis. It happened to Pericles' father. Thank you, stay awake there. It happened to Pericles' father. You just needed a quorum of 6,000 people to vote on their pet hates, and kapow, you were spending the next 10 years twiddling your thumbs in Bulgaria. And you can imagine the sense of personal power and confidence that gave to people who scratched the names of people they didn't like on those pot shots. Can you imagine the exhilaration of catapulting someone off like that? And they saw the instant, deeply gratifying results of their participation in the democratic process. And you can see why some people would like to bring back ostracism today. You know, send Blair back to the Middle East, fantastic. And it was this sense of political confidence, that willingness to challenge and to innovate, that went hand in hand with intellectual confidence and freedom and the Periclean inflorescence. And we rightly dwell today on the imperfections of Athenian democracy, but we should surely accept that no modern democracy is perfect, right? We only gave women the votes in 1928, after Belgium and after Turkey, by the way, and we still have not just unelected hereditary, but unelected religious representatives in our legislature. Do you know that? We do. As for the Americans, they didn't give full civil rights to all races until my own lifetime, and the views of the Athenians on the people of Melos were mild by comparison with the views of, say, Presidents Andrew Jackson or Theodore Roosevelt on the subject of Native American Indians. All democracies are like Pericles and Athens in that we all fall short of the ideal. And the important point about 5th century Greece was that it was the first time that this ideal had been so clearly and beautifully expressed. You read that great speech Pericles made in the winter of 431 to 430 BC, after the first year of that war that he thought Athens would win. How, you said he was going to be printed out. Have people got this speech? Have you had a chance to study this great oration? I'm delighted. Well, this is the meat before him, as Pericles, he stands up. They've had the first year of the war. Loads of people have died. Under a sacred tent before him, he has the bones of the fallen. And all around are the grieving people of Athens, the mothers, the fathers, the widows, the orphans. And he has to explain, he has to console them. He has to sum up what it's all about, what they're fighting for, in words that leap off the page and sound so modern and yet so much better than any modern political speech. He sums up the difference between Athens and the rest of the world. And he says, we enjoy a form of government that does not emulate the institutions of our neighbors. Indeed, we ourselves are more often the model for others than their imitators. Democracy is the name we give to it, since we manage our affairs in the interests of the many, not the few. But though everyone is equal before the law in the matter of private disputes, in terms of public distinction, preferment for office is determined on merit, not by rank or personal not by rank, but by personal worth. Moreover, property is no bar to anyone who has it in them to benefit the city in some way, however lowly their status. A spirit of freedom governs our conduct, not only in public affairs, but also in managing the small tensions of everyday life, where we show no animosity at our neighbor's choice of pleasures, nor cast aspersions that may hurt, even if they do not harm. Although we associate as individuals in this tolerant spirit, in public affairs, a sense of respect makes us the most severely law-abiding of people, obedient to whoever is in authority and to the laws, especially to those established to help victims of injustice, and those laws which, though unwritten, carry the sanction of public disgrace. Don't worry, I'm not going to read the whole thing. You read those words today, and I'm sure, by the way, they're very close to what he actually said, and not some Thucydidean fiction. And you can understand the excitement and pride and self-belief of the Athenians. And the reason those words strike such a chord is that this is still what we believe in and what we aspire to in London today. A city where we are prospering mightily because, unlike so many other places in the world, we are adhering to Periclean principles. He speaks of the rule of law and, above all, the impartiality of the law. And I might remind you that crime in London over the last 6 years, speaking purely entirely at random, has come down by about 18.5%, that we patrol this city with such ruthless impartiality that the police recently detained the Duke of York while loitering in the shrubbery of Buckingham Palace, and that we jail our MPs so much as trying to pass their speeding tickets to their wives, and then we jail their wives as well. And that sends a signal around the world that it is the visible adherence to the rule of law that attracts confidence and investment in London. Furthermore, says Pericles to the Athenians 2,500 years ago, we have provided many diversions from work to refresh the spirit. There are regular public games and festivals of sacrifice throughout the year, while in private we have lovely things at home to delight us every day and drive away our cares. There is no need to enlarge on all the lovely things that you modern Londoners have at home to do in private to drive away your cares. I'm sure you will know what they are. But in the public arena, we have more live music venues than any other city, twice as many theatres as New York, twice as many bookshops as New York, a fifth of the murder rate, by the way, and there could be no greater festival of sacrifice than the 2012 Olympics, where we sacrificed £9.3 billion on the greatest public games the world has ever seen, and whose benefits are yielding an hundredfold to East London. It is worth noting, by the way, that we follow the Periclean example in this crucial respect. He was fast. He was very fast, and we are fast too. It took him only 9 years from 447 to 438 to plan, to finance, to build the Parthenon with all its sublime statuary and sculpture, the same time, by the way, by pure coincidence, that it took us to clear, to plan, to decontaminate the site, and then to build the Olympic venues on time and on budget, as indeed is Crossrail and everything else. And then, 2,500 years ago, Pericles comes to some of the most critical points of comparison between his world and ours. We're both Athens, London, gigantic centres of free trade, free enterprise, with all the benefits that that brings for our populations. Pericles says, because of the importance of our city, the products of the whole world flow in here, and it is our good fortune to enjoy with the same familiar pleasure both our home-produced goods and those of other people. You only have to glance at the kind of Kenyan mange tune and the stuff in the supermarkets to see what he's talking about there. But above all, there speaks a man who understood the importance of transport infrastructure, the need to move goods and people in and out of that emporion, that entrepot, as fast and efficiently as possible. In the early 5th century BC, my friends, the Athenians made the strategically vital decision, against some opposition, to abandon the shallow and congested Phaleron harbour and build a new three-harbour multi-dock 24-hour superport at Piraeus, which Pericles and others connected with those crucial, unbelievably with those crucial long walls to Athens. And that is how Athens became the greatest economic power in Greece. And that is how she achieved the commercial dominance of the Aegean and the rest of the Mediterranean, not just with enough ships bought with Themistocles' silver, but with having a big enough port to cope. And I am sure I do not need to spell out the lesson for the 21st century means of transport, aviation, and the debate about London's airports and the location of certain runways. All of that adds up. The rule of law, good transport, fantastic entertainment, culture based on merit and opportunity. And you can see why people flocked to ancient Athens just as they come to modern London. Like Periclean Athens, we are today the number one tourist city in the world. 16.9 million people last year alone, more than Paris, not spots on New York, etc., etc. They want, or rather they wanted, to live there. And they wanted to work there. And it was in the matter of their treatment of immigration that there was a fundamental difference between Athens and her Spartan enemies. Now, we should be very clear that neither Pericles nor his electorate were remotely soft on immigration, in the sense they made a sharp distinction between native Athenians and everybody else. They held that the very first Athenian, a chap called Erichthonius, had not even arrived there. He didn't immigrate there. He just sprouted from the soil after Athena managed to avoid being raped by Hephaestus and wiped the resulting mess off her dress with some wool and dropped it on the ground. Then Erichthonius sprouted up, apparently. And all the other Athenians were descended from him by more conventional means, I imagine. Anyway, Pericles built on this chauvinistic sentiment, and in 451, he passed a decree that you could only be a full Athenian citizen if both your mother and father were born in Athens. How many of us does that apply? Hey, it's tricky, with the result that thousands of people suddenly found themselves facing huge fines as they were reclassified as resident aliens, non-doms. And if you were one of those resident aliens, or metoiko, or metics, as they were called, you faced many disadvantages. You couldn't vote, you couldn't own land, you faced the risk of arbitrary arrest, you didn't have the same property rights, same legal protections. You faced a pretty swinging non-dom tax of 12 talents a year for a man, 6 talents a year for a woman, far more than anything an Athenian would be asked to pay, and not a course of action I would advise to the Treasury today. And yet, they came in huge numbers at all levels of society. There were probably as many metics, non-resident aliens, non-Athenians, as there were citizens. 50% foreigners, and they were critical to the life of the city. There was millionaire arms dealers like Cephalus, the nice old buffer that we encounter at the beginning of the Republic. There was Pericles' own mistress, the gorgeous and brilliant Aspasia. He loved her. He kissed her when he got home from work every day, and he wept when she was prosecuted for allegedly running a high-class knocking shop, the sort of thing they used to do in Athens in those days. She was held in the highest esteem, and yet she was officially a metic, a foreigner, because she came from Miletus in what is now Turkey. There were loads of foreign intellectuals all over the place, as there are in London today. Rhetoricians like Gorgias of Leontini from Sicily, mathematicians like Theodorus of Cyrene, what now Africa, doctors, Hippocrates of Kos, and so on, and so on. Then, of course, there were the workers, the people who actually made the thing happen. The builders, the plumbers, the plasterers, the potters, the tanners, who gave Athens the leisure that the Athenians needed for their politics and for their speculations. You look at the Erechtheum. I'm just looking around this room now, because the Erechtheum, remember the Erechtheum, which is... Hi, evening. The Erechtheum is, I think I've named after, by the way, Erechthonius, the chap we mentioned earlier. Can you remember how he was born? That's right, him. The Erechtheum is one of the most glorious, you know, it's the one just next to the Parthenon on the Acropolis. Can you see it in your mind's eye? Absolutely extraordinary building, very, very important in the history of architecture. The Porch of the Caryatids, the pillar women, sort of rather burly pillar women with baskets on their heads. That is echoed everywhere in the world now, including Euston Road. The first ever example in the world of the egg and dart motif. If you know what I mean by an egg and dart motif. So it's like egg and a dart, basically. Unfortunately, there aren't any here, but I'm sure that there are many features of the architrave of this building that are owed to the Erechtheum. Who built it? Who built it? We have some of the records. And of the 86 workmen whose status is identifiable, 24 are citizens, 42 are metics, and 20 are slaves. In other words, it was mainly built by the 5th century BC equivalent of Polish plumbers and South African workers. And there you go. We look back from the vantage point of 21st century London, where 40% of the city was born abroad, and we see our spiritual prototype with the same anxieties about immigration, the same patriotism, same nationalism, but also the same willingness to welcome energy and talent if it could be turned to the advantage of the city as a whole. And so Pericles comes to that crucial difference in attitude between Athenians and their rivals. We keep our city open to the world and do not ever expel people to prevent them from learning or observing the sort of thing whose disclosure might benefit an enemy. And the contrast he intends is with the ghastly, self-whipping, olive stone-eating, grisly Spartans, and whose wretched xenophobia meant that every year they expelled every single foreigner in a ritual known as the Exelasia. And you may say, well, look, who won the Peloponnesian War? You might say. And it is perfectly true that long after Pericles had died, and after his successors had made a series of catastrophic mistakes, the war did come to an end with a Spartan victory. But it was a short-term victory. If you seriously wonder which was the more far-sighted policy, openness, which I advocate, or xenophobia, then ask yourself when you last read or heard of any Spartan poetry or Spartan philosophy, or who were the great Spartan tragedians or Spartan painters or Spartan sculptors. Or go to Sparta and stand among the ruins, if you can find those few pathetic courses of stone, and compare them with the miracles that are still to be seen in Athens today, exactly, by the way, as Thucydides prophesied. It was that openness to the world that created the cultural openness, the extraordinary willingness of Athenians to consider new ways of thinking and speaking. It was an irreverent society where the leaders could be mercilessly lampooned, as was Pericles for his onion-shaped head, if I mentioned that already, his devotion to Aspasia. It was an intellectually curious society where people fearlessly postulated that the sun was actually a stone, the earth was round, or that the gods Demeter and Dionysus were just glorified references to the individual human beings who had invented bread, making bread, or growing vines. And as Pericles shows in that amazing passage that I just quoted at such vast length about the Athenian spirit of freedom, remember the spirit of freedom, where we show no animosity at our neighbor's choice of pleasures, it was a world of tolerance, where people could enjoy themselves nearly naked at alcohol-fueled parties in a way, with all sorts of people, in a way that is abundantly, or indeed other people, not necessarily people, in a way that is abundantly depicted, abundant vertebrates at any rate, a way that is abundantly depicted on X-rated red figure vases that have been found in the British Museum. And the Athenian approach to pleasure, therefore, to pleasure, exuberant, though still bound by strict rules and conventions, is the direct predecessor of the innocent hedonism of the modern Londoner at the end of the working day, or possibly the beginning of the working day. And it's that sense that you can have fun. You can have fun and not be judged and not be gossiped about that draws people to a successful metropolis. And it's one of the reasons why Athens today, why London today, rather, is as Athens was, the academic and university capital of the world, the intellectual capital of the world. And then there's one final element that these two cities share, the nuclear rod of the fuel that makes the whole pile vibrate and go critical. Pericles comes to the subject towards the end of his speech when he observes that the whole earth is the tomb of famous men. Of all life's desires, says the great leader, now in his mid-60s, obviously feeling this bit, the love of honor alone never grows old, he says. And that was the Greek ethic. They competed for honor, for prestige. And so indeed have Londoners down the ages. Shakespeare didn't become Shakespeare by sitting alone in a garret in Stratford with a quill in his ear. He came to London and he competed to put bums on seats with Marlowe and Decker and Fletcher and about 12 others, and pow, there was a flash and the cyclotron quivered and he became the greatest writer ever. And in the 17th century, you had the scientific revolution, the same throbbing coffee house competition between Boyle and Hooker Newton and Flamsteed and so on. And you could say the same about rock and roll in the 1960s. You have enough venues, you have enough bands, and you produce the breakthrough, you produce the flash, the Rolling Stones or the Kinks, whatever your taste is. And Athens provided that arena for literary, artistic, musical, and intellectual competition of all kinds, with twice as many festivals as any other city, as a chap called the Old Oligarch gloomily pointed out. And well, the Old Oligarch didn't like Athens, but he pointed out that it had twice as many festivals as any other city. So when Sophocles and Euripides put on their plays at the Dionysia, they weren't just hoping to entertain people, they were hoping to win first prize. It was competitive. And in the end, it was that spirit of competition, love of honor, philotimia, that did Athens in. Most modern historians would agree that the war with Sparta was essentially about who was top dog, wasn't it? Who had the prestige of being called the leader of Hellas. And so the competitive urge that made Athens great was also her downfall. And she ended that long war, as Howell has said quite rightly, weakened and diminished, much as London was at the end of the long cycles of violence that began in 1914 and ended in 1945. And yet 70 years after the end of those wars, this is the amazing thing, folks, that London is still the Athens of the world. And once again, we are the Paidousis, we are the education of the planet. And that is because we've managed to avoid warfare and uphold those essential Periclean ideals of democracy and freedom. And the reason that speech that you've all got, and I hope you've all read, the reason that speech is so thought-provoking and so arresting is that when we look around the world today, we see that the ideals that Pericles articulates are in fact so very far from trite and very far from being universally accepted. Even in Hungary, a country that's only lately joined the EU, we hear the advantage of so-called illiberal democracy. We see the autocracy of the Kremlin. We see the vertiginous rise of our friends in China, defying Fukuyama by embracing the market while maintaining the sole supremacy of the Communist Party, politely and gently damping down the voting power of the people of Hong Kong. And whatever you say about the merits of that approach as a keeper of stability, it is certainly not the heir of Periclean democracy. We see the increasing centralizing power of the European Union, paradoxically eroding the sovereign rights of the people within it, including, of course, the Athenians, who are now being told what to do by the financial directorate in Brussels. Across the Middle East, we see the growing strength of people who actively hate democracy, and who would not only execute gays and oppress women and banish female nudity and all the rest of it, who would smash and destroy virtually every sculptural masterpiece in the Divine Gallery as a matter of so-called religious principle. There are people around the world who in one way or another reject Periclean ideals. Probably more of them as I speak the whole time. And so it's more vital than ever that we uphold those ideals here in London. Let us keep alive that flame. Protect the owl of Pallas Athena that still haunts the squares of Bloomsbury. Fight off those like George Clooney, who would fulfill Hitler's agenda and rip the Parthenon marbles from their place in the heart of our London culture. Let us teach our children the Latin and Greek classics and the derivation of the egg and dart motif, about which I hope I've educated you all tonight. And let us continue, for as long as Londoners have legs and as long as Londoners have nerves, to show the rest of Europe that here in this city, we keep alive the ancient skill of those soldiers we see on those Athenian friezes. By the way, you can see them on the walls of the Athenaeum just outside. We keep alive the ancient skill of those soldiers who are trained to be anabates and apobates, to be able to board and alight from a moving chariot. And let us defy the health and safety fanatics of Brussels by mounting and dismounting the open platform of those beautiful new route masters with the freedom and grace of the hop-on, hop-off, hoplites of Periclean Athens. And that is just a tiny part of what I mean. That is just a tiny part of what I mean by the spirit of freedom that Pericles exalted a spirit of democracy and tolerance and cultural effervescence and mass political participation. That is what we believe in. That is what makes London great. In the Thucydidean phrase, let us keep it as a possession forever. Thank you very much for listening.